Welcome to the CodeCast Podcast. Real-world insights for your daily medical coding and billing processes. And now, here's your host, Terry Fletcher.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 185th episode of the CodeCast Podcast. My name is Terry Fletcher. Hope everyone had a great weekend. We are now into May. I'm getting excited because the weather is changing. Everything's really pretty. My baseball team's doing well. We just had a great NFL draft, so I'm excited about that for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I am a month away from my Napa trip, so it's getting exciting for me. And I can see a light at the end of the tunnel to get a little time of relaxation, just decompress, and hopefully just focus on something other than my phone. So hopefully some of you are seeing some of those lights as well. But let's talk about what we're going to deal with today. And in this episode, I wanted to bring to your attention something that I was reading and researching about when it comes to the potential flexibility rollbacks and commercial payers not allowing for those deductible and copay waivers any longer. I know I talked about that just kind of briefly recently, but my Coding Corner membership clients and my NSCHBC listserv chatter has been very active about patients coming and complaining to physicians and the staff about being upset that they are being charged copays and deductibles when everybody got used to a lot of medical care being free during the 2020 pandemic session. So I want to chat about this because there's a company I follow called Advise Health, and I love some of the information they put out. And it's really enlightening because their articles and content, they're filled by retired HHS, OIG, and DOG agents, so Department of Justice and the Office of Inspector General. So they know what they're talking about. I actually had a chance to share the webinar stage with one of their writers and consultants, and Eric Rubenstein, and him and I, you know, we really hit it off and chatted about a lot of these things. And I think it's important for you to know because a lot of insurers have really said goodbye to waivers for COVID treatments and fees, which is surprising because there was kind of a government, I don't want to say a government mandate because there wasn't. They can only mandate Medicare and Medicaid because that's a government agency. But when you're dealing with commercial plans, they're all about their own contract, and it's really hard to break a contract. Now, what many of the payers did is that they try to be consumer friendly. So they made changes early in the pandemic. Think about like middle empty seats on an airplane. So health insurers try to be that, they call it nice, even though they've seen record high profits, but they voluntarily waived deductibles and payments and other costs for insured patients who were sick or fell ill with COVID-19 and needed hospital care, doctor visits, medications, or other treatment. Now, not everybody did. And we saw a lot of those posted saying, oh my gosh, I just got a $16,000 bill for COVID. But, you know, some of the payers that did do that, they did it for public relations standpoint. Let's face it, the industry got credit for helping customers through tough times, and it had political and financial benefits for those insurers too. And so they're like, look what we're doing. Even though they were stalled with having to pay elective cases, it was just a PR move, in my opinion, in there, because it actually worked in their favor not to have to pay for elective surgeries. But as we know in the real world, nothing lasts forever. So starting at the end of last year and continuing into the spring, a growing number of insurers quietly ended those fee waivers for COVID treatment and for a lot of other policies. When it comes to treatment, more and more consumers will find that their normal course of deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurances will still apply. So the good news is that vaccines, that they can't charge for that. They can't, the patients can't be charged for that, I should say, because the government's funding it. And most COVID tests still should be free. So that's part of that, unless it's pre-op. And that's because federal law requires insurers to waive costs for specific testing rules and all vaccinations. So that's actually a good thing. Now, luckily, because we've seen so many things rolled back from what the Trump administration did, but early in January, Joe Biden, his team, I guess, they reinforced some of the Trump administration rules about waiving cost sharing for testing and said it applies even in situations where an asymptomatic person wants to get tested before, let's say, visiting a relative. Now, for some reason, hospitals that have a pre-op mandate for a patient who has, you know, no suspected reason to have COVID, they're not covering those on a lot of cases. And I'm saying they're in a general sense for, I know, UnitedHealthcare, for example. But treatment is different than testing. So insurers, again, voluntarily waived those costs so that they can decide when to reinstate them. So the initial step not to charge treatment fees may have preempted any effort by the federal government to mandate it, and I think that's why they did it. And it also kind of fed into some of the things that when they brought back the Affordable Care Act, a study released in November. Let me explain what this did. So this study basically said by researchers, it found that about 88% of people covered by insurance plans, those bought by individuals and some by employers, had policies that waived such payments at some point during the pandemic. And many of those waivers were expected to expire by the end of the year or early this year. And a lot did. So let me give you some examples. Anthem, for example, stopped them at the end of January. UnitedHealthcare, another of the nation's largest insurers, they began rolling back waivers last fall and then finishing up at the end of March. And deductible-free inpatient treatment for COVID for Aetna, that expired February 28th. I hope you're looking at these companies' websites because your patients, they need to be aware of this. A few insurers continue to forego patient cost sharing in some type of policies. Humana, for example, has left the cost sharing waiver in place for Medicare Advantage members only, but dropped it January 1st for those in employer-based group plans. So not all are making the changes. So for example, Premera Blue Cross in Washington and Sharp Health Plan in California extended treatment cost waivers through June for COVID. Kaiser Permanente said that it was keeping its program in place for members diagnosed with COVID and has not set an end date. But do you hear what I said there? Diagnosed with COVID. And then UPMC in Pittsburgh planned to continue to waive all copayments and deductibles only for in-network treatment through April 20th, which will be interesting because of the no surprise rule now that has for inpatient hospital. So that'll be interesting how that works there. So what does this mean? So waivers may result in little savings for people with mild cases of COVID who are treated at home, but the savings for patients who fall seriously ill and wind up in the hospital, that could be substantial. So emergency room and hospitalizations, those are expensive, and many insured patients must pay a portion of those costs, typically through deductibles before coverage kicks in. And let's face it, deductibles have been on the rise for years. I remember, and some of you may remember this, remember when you were excited when your deductible was $100 or $250 for family? Well, single coverage deductibles for people who work for large employers, the average right now, and this is a study done in 2020, is $1,418, while those for employees of smaller firms are about $2,295. And I don't understand the definition or the phrase the Affordable Care Act, because the annual deductibles for Affordable Care Act start at $3,000 and higher. It depends on the plan type. And both kinds of coverage also include co-payments, which are flat dollar amounts, often co-insurance. Those are a percentage of the cost of office visits, hospital stays, and prescription drugs. So ending the waivers for treatment, that's a big deal if you get sick and you find out you have to pay $5,000 out of pocket that maybe, you know, your cousin or your uncle didn't have to a couple of months ago. But these patients' fees represent only really kind of a small slice of overall costs of caring for a hospitalized patient that actually has a severe case of COVID. It does help patients' cash flow, but insurers saw other kinds of benefits. So one thing, insurers recognized early on that patients facing stay-at-home orders and other restrictions were avoiding medical care in droves. And of course, this drove down what insurers had to fork out for elective cases and medical care. And I think they were realizing that they were going to report a pretty good profit year because they could see utilization dropping like a rock. And so doctors, hospitals, you saw restaurants, everyone else was going to be in big trouble. So it was good politics for them. It's good PR to waive copays and deductibles before it was mandated. So here's the other thing that you have to understand about payers. And this is something that I thought was interesting because I knew some of this, but I didn't know all of it. So think about this as far as don't get all gushy about your payer, you know, generating goodwill here, because under the ACA, insurers are required to spend at least 80% of their premium revenue on direct healthcare rather than on marketing and administration. And large groups must spend 85%. By waiving those fees to patients, insurers' own spending went up a little bit, potentially helping to offset some of the share of what they're expected to pay, you might see a rebate as well. That's because insurers whose spending on direct medical care fall short of that threshold, and they must issue rebates if they didn't meet that threshold by August 1st to the individuals or employers who purchased the plans. You know, they don't want to pay any money back. And so a record $2.5 billion actually was rebated for policies in 2019, with the average rebate per person who pays for their own out-of-pocket or an employer was about $219. So knowing spending was falling drastically during the pandemic, I'm sure this helped fuel decisions to payers to waive patient co-pays and treatments, since they knew they were going to have to give this money back one way or another because of the rebates. But you would think they would just give it back to the patient. Not necessarily. The consumer's kind of lost a little bit here. But if they completely offset the rebates through cost sharing, then it strictly benefits only those with COVID needing significant treatment. But if they issue rebates, there's more of a broad distribution. So even with that, the insurers are going to see a lot of rebates this fall. They're going to have to because of everything that was halted. And I'm still seeing some hospitals because there's an uptick in some areas, even with the vaccines rolling out, where they're not able to get all of the elective cases on there. And then the rebates are likely driven in part also by suppressed healthcare utilization, obviously during the COVID pandemic. But the biggest thing that you just have to keep in mind is that the payers, even though it's like, oh, guess what my insurance companies do? It's really not all goodwill. And it's mostly has to do with PR, politics, and the fact that they have to pay it back in some sort if they don't. And if they didn't do that, think about this. It would have been mandated that they at least attempt to do that like they did with Medicare. So I just wanted you to be aware of that because you need to go to whatever your biggest payer is and go down the list. I would say your top five. Figure out exactly what's happening for your patients because they are going to feel the brunt of this. And if you're not basically proactive and figure out that your patients, when you schedule them for something, do not still have the same share of cost regulations and rules, then they may be coming back on you saying, well, I thought I didn't have to pay for it and you didn't tell me, even though it's not technically your responsibility, it is your responsibility to at least know what's going on. And that's one of the reasons why the OIG and the HHS OIG, basically they started their audits again, because they felt during some of the investigation and oversight post, you know, pandemic of 6 months, 7 months into it, that there was a lot of overutilization because patients didn't have to pay out of pocket. And so just be aware that a lot of that is happening. Okay, so now we want to get into our coding question. But I wanted to preface this, so everybody's probably going to be like, uh-oh. So I saw a coding question that was in one of the coding alerts, and I contribute to several coding alerts. I really like the practice management coding alert, since I'm a certified practice manager as well, and then also cardiology coding alert. Both of those, I am an editorial advisory member. But I saw something in the orthopedic coding alert that it wasn't completely incorrect, but there was a question in there that was not 100% accurate, and I want to address it. So the question was, and it was one from one of their Delaware subscribers. It says, can we report inpatient telehealth evaluation and management services to Medicare, such as 99221 to 99223? This has happened in some cases in our practice due to COVID. Okay, so their answer was, as of February 2021, Medicare will include the following codes as temporarily reimbursable during the public health emergency. And that's 99221 to 99223. And then it directed them to access a current list of Medicare-covered telehealth services. Well, that's half right. So let me clarify for those of you that are seeing patients inpatient still, and under telehealth. And let me explain how that works. So let's say your physician's in the office and they have a patient that is quarantined in the hospital. And again, to slow the spread, so your physician isn't exposed, they need to see that patient. And the hospital has set up a telehealth monitor and screen, and they can do that. Can they bill a 99221 to 223 code? If it's known to, if that patient is known to the provider, so they are an established patient, because remember those codes, initial hospital, are for new and established patients, yes, they can bill those with a 95 modifier, and place of service would be 21 for inpatient. But remember when telehealth came out and the direction and the HCPCS codes that are available under telehealth. Let's say your physician was called to do a consult on a patient that is inpatient Medicare age and they've never seen them before. Well, and they're going to do it through telehealth. That is not the initial hospital codes. Those were HCPCS codes, G0425 to G0427. They're time-based codes. G0425, for example, is 30 minutes. And what those codes actually say are, for example, G0425. That's a valid code under telehealth for consultation, emergency department, or initial inpatient, typically 30 minutes communicating with the patient via telehealth, and it can be a consult or an inpatient visit. Remember that if you haven't seen the patient at all, the provider, and they haven't seen them at all, so no face-to-face, they're not their patient, and they're being asked to see a patient in the hospital, either under consult or to admit them, you have to use the G codes under telehealth. If it's their patient, so they've had a face-to-face, they've seen that patient before, then they can go ahead and use the 99221 to 223 and get paid that reimbursement. The reason is that Medicare is tracking this under the telehealth services because they want to know how many inpatients needed services. And if you haven't seen the patient before, it's hard to reimburse the physician that high-weighted code because they're not doing a full and complete visit. It's basically being done via telehealth. Now, in this scenario as well, your place of service would be O2, wouldn't be the hospital because it already says it's emergency department or inpatient. And so you're going to get a facility rate on this. It's about $50 less than the other codes, but again, you're coding it correctly. So I just wanted to make that clarification because it kind of leads people to believe that you can bill it no matter what. And I would just hate for practices to get into a habit of that when once these services are rolled back. Our coding question is brought to you today by JP Morgan Private Bank. Connect with over 200 years of experience, service, and stability. JP Morgan Securities, JP Morgan Chase Bank, privatebank.jpmorgan.com. Okay, so hopefully everybody is good today with our topic. I was kind of excited about that because I was thinking, you know, we need to make sure that everyone gets a lot of that information. So my personal tidbit this week, it is Mother's Day coming up. So happy Mother's Day in advance to all of you moms out there, grandmothers, stepmothers, acting as mothers, wherever your role is as in that mother role. I wish you a happy Mother's Day coming up this weekend. My daughter's coming out. I might have mentioned that before, and it's going to be all wedding all the time this weekend. So we're doing dress shopping and we're going to brunch and, I'm flying out her friend from Atlanta, so her maid of honor. So I'm excited. It's going to be a really good weekend. I only get her for 2 days, and I'm pretty excited about what we're going to be doing. So anyway, it's fun. Mom's happy, and I get to see my girl. So everyone, that's it for me this week. Make it a great day, and I will talk to you next week on the CodeCast podcast. Thanks for listening.
For more information on medical coding, billing, auditing, and compliance, including how to hire Terry, follow Terry on Twitter at TerryCoder1 or visit her website at www.terryfletcher.net. Podcast producer Joe Kuzma. Music producer DeSassin Music.